Are you ready?
Welcome back.
No.
One more, and then we have a break. I will get out the new dates to you one of these days. For the, you know, we're always a little bit short in the fall, and then we have more classes in the winter, just because it's a little bit time. It's a little bit, yeah, it's from September to now, it's maximum eight, somewhere between six and eight meetings. And in the winter, we usually have eight to ten. Well, we got a little bogged down, at least I got a little bogged down on page 351 at the end of the second column. So I'm going to pick up at the end of the first column. I think I understand it. There's one or two places I'm confused. Maybe you can jump in. Just to set the stage, I think that will help. We have the war going on, and we have the church, and there's no relationship between the two. That, I think, is the background of this material. How is it, if religion is working, that a whole continent could have slipped into barbaric behavior? That's what's in the background, I think. The other thing to remember, Abraxas is, and I think a very good summing up of the way Abraxas was appearing in history, is on 350, the second column, 1, 2, 3, 4, six lines up. The overpowering essence of events. So the idea is that something is causing that war, and what is causing it is the part of human nature that we don't acknowledge exists. If we say that, going with the biblical idea on a psychological level, that God made us in his own image, then our grasp of ourselves and our grasp of the God image are parallel. So when we exclude a certain aspect of our psyche, that is also going to be excluded from the God image. And that's exactly what we're acting out in this war. That's Abraxas. So on one hand, you could say Abraxas is a part of ourselves. On the other hand, you could say Abraxas is part of the God image. So what he's doing, he's going back and reevaluating the nature of God from a psychological standpoint, from the angle of what's missing. What's missing in God is what's missing in our grasp of ourselves, and it's what's being played out in those wars. That, I think, is the background. And so that's how he gets to the overpowering essence of events, those events being the overpowering of the violence of the First World War. And a couple other things I read you, but I'll just remind you, from the Vision Seminar, page 1042, Abraxas doesn't conform to our spiritual expectations, but to our worst fears, saying the same thing in a different way. We have this idea of God, but it's so limited that it allows events to happen, and we just throw up our hands. How did this war happen? Well, it didn't happen. We're doing it. We are doing these things that we throw our hands up and say, look how destructive that was. No, look how destructive we are. And so that's what he's going on. And page 830 in the visions, he says, you find that the God is really warlike. Again, he's speaking of Abraxas there. And then he says on page 811, if she identifies with Abraxas, she'll act like a monster. Well, that's the monstrosity of the war. So he's going to be now comparing our Christian idea of God and the devil, because they belong together, and Abraxas. and doing so because Abraxas is what is missing from our God image, from our grasp of ourselves, and what we don't symbolize and acknowledge we live out. That may help. And so at the bottom of the first column on 351, the idea is that there's this single God, which is the Christian God, and he's a good God. Of course, he's got his shadow brother, the devil. But he's contrasting that with the multiplicity of Abraxas, meaning Abraxas is made up of all sorts of contradictory, violent, greedy, mean, warlike, conquering, predatory sides, and that's exactly what we don't acknowledge in ourselves. So he's trying to drive home the idea of a multiplicity of gods. A multiplicity in the Abraxas God image.
Even make that clear.
No, this is my interpretation, of course, but I think it makes sense.
Well, he may not have even gotten to that point, because I think. I was reading in Memories, James and Reflections, that he said it took him 20 years of writing to even come to some basic understanding of the stuff that he
was. Yeah. It's astounding what's coming up, I think. It's incredibly rich and therefore incredibly complicated. And you know, if you've ever studied theology, I don't recommend it. But this is what 20th century theology has been working on for 100 years. So it's really, in raw form, the thoughts that many people have taken up. If you don't deal with multiplicity, he's saying at the bottom there of the first column on 351, and you are satisfied with the single God, think the old understanding of God the protecting Father, what you create is mutilation. So he's saying this is the cause of the war. And then the next sentence is what I was trying to drive at. How can you be true to your own nature when you try to turn the many into one? Second line on the second column on 351. Meaning, our grasp of ourselves, there's a parallel between our grasp of ourselves and our grasp of God. And if you think God is good, then you can only be good. But what about the parts of you that aren't good? And so on. So he's drawing this parallel between self-understanding and the God image. And that last line on that paragraph, thus your nature is maimed. So a good God and a good understanding of yourself doesn't leave room for nature, because nature is both good and bad. There are sunny days and there are typhoons. Now, I think that's the idea he's going with for several paragraphs. Equality prevails not for the sake of God, but only for the sake of man. So it's our need to feel equal that wants us to see God as just. That makes sense? And he's dispelling the way we have seen God, because as he's putting it, the way we see God is simply an extension of the way we see ourselves. And we limit God by seeing God through that filter. And therefore we limit our grasp of ourselves, and it That part we don't grasp is what we actually live out.
This makes so much sense because know thyself is what's engraved on the Temple of Apollo in Delphi. And I read several reference books and everybody was really having a hard time with it. What is this? What does this really mean? And one said, well, it means moderation and everything and all, you know, and I thought, No. Okay. All right, that really helps.
You know, I mean, the beauty of the Greeks, I think, is that their gods were so complex. And Zeus was a philanderer, and Hermes was a thief. And they didn't exclude the grasp of human nature by their grasp of divinity. Unfortunately, it was all unconscious, but still they acknowledged it, though they didn't take responsibility for it.
Right.
Yeah. It's a, you know, it's a power. Well, you go to these Christian Jungian things, and it's all about goodness. And try to bring up a shadow, it'll kill you. Equality. Now, the gods are mighty and endure. So the gods are what they are, and our attempt to see them in a certain way is an extension of ourselves. Now, this next sentence is puzzling. Therefore, the gods. Well, I should back up. Like stars, they abide in solitude, separated by vast distances. So, all the qualities of the within the god or gods. Exist separately. They're not hooked up. That's the nature of the unconscious psyche anyway. You know, people say two contradictory things in the same sentence, which we've seen in many texts we've read. Okay, so, but that is the nature of the unconscious, and we have to face that. Therefore, they dwell together and need communion so that they may bear their separateness. Now that's, I think that anticipates anticipates where we're going, namely community. We'll start talking about community. What he's saying is community really is based on our seeing our own complexes. I believe he's redefining what really binds people together.
How so? You're saying community is based on seeing our complexes.
Yeah.
What? How do you mean that?
Well, I don't know. But I'll guess. See, I think he's anticipating the self here. When you are in touch with your own complexity, first of all, it's harder to judge. Because you say, well, look at that person. They are X, Y, and Z. And then you realize, oh, shit, I'm X, Y, and Z. So it's the foundation of Eros. And I believe this is something he's just working out himself here. Secondly, and maybe even more importantly, if you are in touch with your fragmentation, that is the precondition for the self to emerge. And this is all down the road for him, but the self isn't just personal.
So it's a conscious community, because an unconscious community can be out of touch with your consciousness, because they're still tightly bound together.
Yeah, that would be what we call enmeshment.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's saying tons of words in these simple sentences that the Christian idea of goodness can't lead to community because you project what is bad on other people, and that starts the squabbling. And the self can't manifest as long as you're identified with only one of your opposites.
It seems to me there could be communities that join together and they all have the complex of the goodness complex, and
yeah.
So that binds them together.
Right.
And that's a lot of mm-hmm. Christianity. And so they're bound together, and then they judge others so harshly against, mm-hmm. To fortify their conflict.
Mm-hmm.
But then the community of the self is a whole different thing.
It's a much different thing. And, both exist, certainly not much of the latter.
Mm-hmm.
but remember, this is the unconscious just throwing out a different way of looking at life.
So the community of the self, to me, would be, there's opening there.
Right.
So that new ideas and creativity and all of this stuff, new understanding of one's complexes and self can come in, whereas the other kind of community based on complex that binds is so tightly shut down that nothing new can...
Yep.
It's like this... a wound with a big, huge scar over it, and that can't break open. But with
mm-hmm.
the community of the self, that breaks open, and new
yep.
things can come in. Okay. I have to get it clear in my head.
It's a new way of understanding, because it looks like individuation, just the word suggests isolation, and it doesn't. But it's a different way of connecting. And I think what you were saying, the thing that's helped me is a community based on an ideal
mm-hmm.
always needs a scapegoat.
Mm-hmm. And that could be a family, an organization, a church, a world, a country. You can go on and on.
Business.
Absolutely.
I just,
it's a part of the whole business ethos. I mean, that's
yeah.
how you build a community in business. You pit them against somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have an enemy in order to
mm-hmm.
You have to have an enemy in order to build.
I just read a paper by a guy who I don't know. He's a Jungian in California. I'm not even sure if he's still alive. But he works with businesses. And what he does is he finds where the scapegoat is. He brings that in, makes him deal with it. Yeah.
Sounds like somebody's going to go broke.
Maybe he does all his private practice. I don't know. But,
I can't imagine people buying that because unfortunately, when you are coming out of enmeshment, it feels like abandonment.
Yeah.
And it feels like destruction. It doesn't feel like...
It's terrible.
Apart. Yeah. You're ripping open that scar that's
so those of you in business, we've talked here about how horrible it's becoming, and bullying, is now an epidemic, I think. And I think this is new in the last 20 years. Those of you, you saw that change in business or not change, but everywhere I hear it's bullying. People are just, the ones with integrity are being massacred, and that's what he's trying to get at. So these little sentences contain worlds of implications. I think that's one reason this is so hard to digest.
Now I understand a little bit more about the community of self being the foundation.
Yeah.
Eros, because you're looking at yourself, that you're seeing yourself in other people, so you can communicate with them, commune with them, learn from them, and... Is that what you meant?
Yeah, and because you don't, you're less likely to project your shadow.
Okay.
But I think also, and this is in a kind of mystical thing maybe, but the self enters in and changes the feelings for the other person. It's a different level of consciousness.
Or once the projection takes place, to start the process, you can then back up and grow through that and pull that back. I think it would still be projection, but...
I think projection is kind of a holy, right. I think it's a holy thing. It's an opportunity to learn something right. about yourself, but you have to be consciously aware right. of it.
Yeah, and if you're...
Being that, yeah, in a normal business thing, you would you would have the projection, and that would be the end of it.
When I think when you've been ground up and you realize your own psyche is a mess, you're less defensive when you have to face what you're projecting. Maybe it does exist in all communities, but it's the intensity and intractability of the projection.
So when the self enters in a dialogue, hopefully is possible with yourself.
Another way to put it, but still I think another energy is present. What he's driving at is, as the self can transform an individual, so it can transform a group.
Well, it's like analysis. You know, there's a third thing present there.
Yeah.
It's just not you and,
right.
and the analyst. The self comes in there and does something.
Right.
I don't know what.
We don't know what. I mean, it's only the language of poets that can describe it. But I believe that's why he makes this leap between the gods and communion. And as he says, I teach you the reprehensible for whose sake I was rejected. Like you said, we don't want to deal with it. And for me, it's so profoundly in the spirit of true religious consciousness, but if you would try to discuss this in most traditional contexts, well, you would be called a heretic. Numberless gods await the human state. Again, this relationship, the third paragraph, between our image of God and our image of ourselves. If we have a... recognition that God is complex, we're more likely to be able to own up to our own complexity, and if we own up to our own complexity, we're less likely to project our shadow, or we're willing to hear feedback when we are, and there's this other thing that, this third thing that enters in, that is really the foundation of community.
I'm thinking that Jung and Emma know that, you know, to accept someone's betrayal of you, you have to really realize, well, I've betrayed before too, and otherwise they probably never could stay together. But betrayal is a hard one to swallow.
Maybe the hardest. But it's true. I mean, if you've been betrayed and you think, oh, that's a bitch, yeah. You think, well, I was 19, I betrayed. I did the same thing. And then it's not that the pain isn't there, but you have a different relationship.
It's almost like you have an ability to accept it that you didn't have before.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
Otherwise,
you know, well, I think the things I did when I was 19, oh my God. And I should be going to hell right now.
And I think also, it's one thing to blindly and unconsciously betray someone and then realize later that's what you did. But for him to go into it knowing, I think that's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And she accepted
knowing.
Yeah. Yeah. I think to me, it's almost more powerful that he went into it knowing.
Well, that's quite relevant, because when we get to the white bird, I believe that's about the affair. We'll talk about that. So we're really talking about a general social situation, and then he doesn't really mention it, but I think we can say, oh, and this is his personal version of what he was seeing as a general shift in consciousness, and he lived it in his own life.
But surely in the dynamic that we're talking about, their definitions, even if they use the word betrayal, if they were using the word betrayal, their definitions of betrayal were changing. I mean, it wasn't ultimately a betrayal.
Right. There were no lies. But it hurt, I think.
That might be.
Yeah.
But, I mean, if they were really open with one another and you know, were addressing the, what promises they'd made to one another, you know, and in an open marriage, I mean, where a couple is open to, with one another, this can happen, then if they were trying to be as big and as comprehensive as they could possibly be, they may have been definitely shifting their views of what was betrayal.
Mm-hmm. Well, if it, you know, when you're thinking that the one, if the one person loves one person and then the other one starts loving someone else and you don't, that, it hurts.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, even though you, they were talking about it, I'm sure, daily, but...
Oh, yeah. I would say shouting about it still.
You're betraying, you know, what, whatever expectations they had of traditional marriage, that one person, one love, one person, and that would be reciprocated, that broke. So, you know, betrayals are different, you could call it different levels, but, you know, they were basically breaking the traditional expectations of a non-marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that's...
Much more
you could say, oh, I'm big and I'm so emotionally mature and I can accept this, but you, somewhere you're going to get damn pissed off and be hurt.
Well, one thing I learned in Switzerland, I talked to one of the staff there, who I ended up not really trusting, but he did know some members of the Jung family. He didn't realize that Emma Jung really was furious. And there were many, many scenes. It wasn't like, oh, I accept this. And she seriously considered divorce. And so it was not without a terrific battle that this happened. You were shaking your head, Anne. I think we should give your voice a chance.
Oh, no, it's something of personal thought.
Okay, all right.
I see this as a huge betrayal, and I see him stepping into it consciously knowing it's going to be that big betrayal. And I don't know if that's true, but that's the way I see it. And I just think that it is amazing. If the self asked me to do that, I don't know that I would. I don't know that I could. And I guess that's where I'm at with that.
And how does one know if the self asks?
Right.
For sure.
How do you make that decision? That's just this, it's something that I toss around in my mind, and I just.
Well, we'll get there. Keep that question open. Keep the word, because I think this is what he's wrestling with. All in these pages, for himself personally, but then seeing its parallel in the bigger picture. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Okay.
I'm agreeing with Jane on an emotional level. I just slowly they must have been working, at least trying to even in their anger redefine some things.
Yeah, that's for sure. I think, you know, the part of the problem is, well, what is betrayal? I don't know if we should get into that, but what was different about when I think of betrayal, I think of lies, and there were no lies, as far as I know. Still, there was a breaking of trust, and then I think reestablishing it on a higher level, but not without, I'm sure, some real screams. Okay, so. Now, this next paragraph is worlds of theology. Thus, just as it is no use to reflect upon the Pleroma, it is not worthwhile to worship the multiplicity of the gods. So what he's doing in that paragraph, he's redefining what worship is. And what worship will be for him is fulfilling your meaning. I think that's, we could go into those other sentences if you'd like, but that's the main thrust of that paragraph.
And you know what's interesting is that if you look at that Christian story about Judas betraying Christ, mm-hmm. we look at it so naively, you know, if we're raised Christian or Catholic or whatever. But, you know, Christ, to accept that betrayal, he had to have done it somewhere mm-hmm. or some, at some point to mm-hmm. be emotionally able to do that. And so if we really look at Christ in a broader sense, like
yeah.
we would say, oh yeah, he's a betrayer.
Yeah.
Because otherwise he wouldn't have been able to accept Jesus as a betrayer.
I think we got to distinguish between Christendom and Christianity. Because you can see it, I think you can see hints of this complexity in the biblical picture of Christ. But it's just not what we've made of it. And who knows what the church fathers sliced out of the canon anyway.
I always felt like Judas was fulfilling his meaning and his role
mm-hmm.
in order for the Christian myth to carry forward and Christianity to do what it needed to do in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So
the Gospel of Judas says something like that, right? That he didn't want to do this, but he was the one chosen to. He was closest to Christ. And therefore had to help him make the sacrifice or something like that.
Christ asked him to.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's one they act out, too.
Right.
That's one
too complex.
Yeah.
Act out. Okay. Can't think like that.
Mm-hmm. Maybe I will look at one other sentence here. But by our prayer, oh, maybe we should read the whole damn thing. least of all does it serve to worship the first God. Okay, that's what we were talking about. The effective fullness and the summum bonum, the height of goodness, and the greatest good, I guess you'd say. Now, because this anticipates something we'll be doing later, the bright gods form the heavenly world. Wait a minute. No, sorry. But our prayer can add nothing to it and take nothing from it because effective emptiness gulps down everything. I think what he's getting at there is what is it that lasts? And doing something because it's good won't last. Doing something because you are fulfilling your being in the quest to reconcile your split, that lasts. Now, why are we reading Jung and not Eric Byrne or Fritz Perl? You see, they didn't last. A lot of stuff appears and disappears, and it doesn't last. What Jung is saying is there is a quality, and I'll later talk about it as eternity. And I think we can look at eternity in a couple of senses, and one of them is, what has a long duration? What do we give to life that outlives us? And serving goodness isn't the way to do it. That's what I get out of that paragraph. I mention it because it'll come up later, this idea of the eternal. And these words are so grand, but we can pin them down to everyday experience, and I think that makes it a little easier.
There's a Joni Mitchell phrase that just came to mind in one of her songs. She writes, "Everything comes and goes, marked by lovers and styles of clothes. Things that you held high and told yourself were true, lost or changed as the days come down to you." I think that kind of speaks to this for me.
Say that again.
"Everything comes and goes, marked by lovers and styles of clothes. Things that you held high and told yourself were true are lost or changed as the days come down to you." And that could be those things that aren't lasting.
That don't last.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And with you sort of kind of shifting into the idea of the self.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which you might not have been intended.
Mm-hmm.
So back for a discussion. We can't worship the effect of fullness, that is, Abraxas. Because...
Right.
Because he is only effect, and non-effect is also out there to undercut it. And...
Okay.
And the totality will have to encompass both. That is in the self.
Yeah, but there's another thing, I think, that worship by its very nature leads nowhere. It's putting into time and space the complexity that we first need as a praxis that lasts. Well, he's trying to get us to redefine what worship is and what prayer is. Both. And to take the old attitude toward the new God is just as destructive as the old attitude toward the old God. Sorry, to take the old attitude toward the new God is just as destructive as the old attitude toward the old God. We have to change our idea of what God is and our idea of what worship and prayer is. And prayer and worship for him is going to be fulfilling your meaning.
All right, you said, I just didn't catch the fact that you were using worship when you first said it.
Yeah.
More limited way.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
Then the dark gods, so he goes back to the dark gods and the light gods are two sides of the same old god coin. And that continues till here the dead interrupted. So he's just trying to contrast multiplicity versus the old idea of God and what that means in terms of our self-understanding and what it means in the way we live a religious life. And of course, the dead are not pleased.
When he talks about this effect of emptiness, is he kind of saying that the God that you would pray to that needs prayers and worship, that's a void that would just gobble everything up, that you could never fill that void with prayer and worship, because that's really what
that'd be a way to put it. Yeah.
Necessary.
Yeah.
Really fulfilling your meaning,
mm-hmm,
would be a way to fill that emptiness and that void.
Yeah. So you wouldn't say, God, do this for me. You would say, what is God asking me to do? That's the shift. Mm-hmm. And remember, this is just raw unconscious. I think, you know, as he would re-examine this and rephrase it, he would come to say things like, well, I do accept prayer, but I pray for guidance in achieving what I'm here to achieve.
And that, for him, came in many ways that would not have been accepted.
Right.
Like dreams.
Yeah.
Synchronicity.
Right. And all the work he did alone, away from his family. Now, so the dead complained, blah, blah, blah. And then where we got stuck was in the last paragraph. My son, Philemon replied, these dead have rejected the single and highest God. Remember, the dead have come back from Jerusalem. So the dead would be the part of the Western psyche that is no longer fed by the old idea of God. You might say they're the atheists of the Western psyche, but still wanting an answer. They go to Jerusalem, they go back to the original source of the message, but they're not satisfied with that, though they can't give up their longing for it. This is why it gets so complicated here. And then the next sentence, so how can I teach them about the one and only and not multifarious God? So he's saying they've already given up their belief in the single God. How can I teach them about it? I'm not even going to bother. Now this next part confuses me a little bit. I'll tell you what I think. You may have your own opinion. They must, of course, believe me. I think what he's saying is, hey, listen up, group. I've got something to tell you. They have rejected their belief in the old God. I'm adding that. So I teach them the God that I know, the multifarious and extended, who is both the thing and its appearance. So what he's saying is, here are the dead. They don't like the old, yet they keep longing for the old. They probably want to hear me talk about the old. Why would I do that? They're not going to listen to me anyway, so I'm going to tell them about the new. That's what I get out of that. Basically, if you get confused, we're just circling around this idea of the complexity of God versus the singularity of God and how important that is. And that's his answer to what's going on in the war, where theology said God is dead. How could a God allow this to happen? What he's saying is it is precisely our image of God that is allowing this to happen. Because this is the part, this war is the part of our psyche that our God doesn't symbolize, and therefore we ignore in ourselves. And then the reason I say that is on 352, he gets on a roll. Look, you guys, look at all the things your single God has led you to do. You slaughter, you disregard nature, you are interested in power, and so on. So look at the effects of your idea of God as good. And that's those two paragraphs, first two paragraphs on 352, first column. Your hand grasped the earth and tore off the halo. So you've spoiled the earth, and so on. You spoiled the trees. You've chopped up and gave everything a place, but in doing so, you disregarded its importance.
That idea struck me, the idea that they named and weighed and numbered, and which is part of our society too.
So absolutely.
We have to know. It's the, yeah. To me, that speaks to needing to know.
It's the finger of charge.
Right.
Control. You know,
yeah. As a friend of mine says, if you can't weigh it, poke it, and put it in a box, it doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know,
yeah.
That is so prevalent.
But when we are so sure, then nothing new can enter it.
Right. And the world isn't boxable. Okay. So then we get to an ending, an important paragraph, which is just repeating, but in a nice, concise way, the effect of having God be unipolar. This is no polytheism that I have made up. But many gods who powerfully raise their voices and tear humanity to bloody pieces. So it is the unacknowledged multiplicity of our own psyches that is also not contained in our idea of God that is leading to the war. So and so many men weighed, numbered, apportioned, hacked, and devoured. Therefore I speak of many gods as I speak of many things, since I know them. Why do I call them gods? for the sake of their superiority. In other words, these are the forces that are really shaping the way we act.
And here is he talking about the archetypes then?
Yeah, or, okay. All those parts of Abraxas which are shaping history, people would say, well, but why would you call that God? And he's saying, I'm calling it God, because that's what's making us move. For me, what God is at least a portrait of the forces that are determining the way we behave as nations.
And I think going back to that paragraph, the last one of the last column, where he says, they must of course believe me. Sometimes when you hear a truth, that all the evidence is there, you can see it, but you don't want to. You can say whatever you want, but you have to believe it. It's that clear.
You can't not know anymore.
And of course the dead aren't very happy about this. And he says, he refers to the worship of the holy trees as what they have ignored, which would be the old pagan religions. Remember, the Germans and the Celts worshipped trees. And Philemon then says in that last paragraph, Mother, may your son be strong. So he is the voice of the earth, of respect for nature. But, and how dark is your place of your light? And I think there it's that this war thing is showing us what we have ignored. It's a horrible thing, but if we can learn from it, it can be a new light, which is what he's trying to do. Questions on that? Sermon 4. Basically, it's a diatribe against God is good. And then he tries to explain why.
Really, in his sense, this is This is a prayer.
This is a prayer, absolutely. And his transforming this into Jungian psychology was his worship. Definitely. And I have seen that. I think I told you, I've seen at least one case of a woman who was she called herself a recovering Catholic, but longed for the Mass, and she really missed going to church, but she couldn't stomach it anymore. And so we worked on understanding who she was, why she was here, and she made some shifts, put them into life, and she dreamt she was back in the Mass. So the Mass became the fulfillment of herself, and then she was satisfied. That's where I have seen this relevant. It gives the same feeling of satisfaction that the Mass once gave.
Was she able to return to the Mass?
No. But felt satisfied by fulfilling her life like she had felt satisfied in the Mass.
Well, often wondered if
she
could answer whether someone who's gone through that could actually sort of literally go back and partake of the Mass, and, you know, because they on a motion, emotional level, it's, you know, in the early parts of their lives, they had spoken so strongly and just somehow shift that emotion onto the self and participate in the mass as though it were an active way, as though it were part of the self. Can anyone do that?
I've read about a man who did. I can't remember, this has been a long time ago. He had been in analysis remaining, even has been an analyst. But he came back to it with just a whole new perspective.
Mm-hmm. I think so, sure.
So I'm sure it can be done.
Mm-hmm. The problem is, if the priest would keep his mouth shut. I could have gone back for the ritual, but I could not go back and listen to what was coming out of his mouth.
I go when nephews made their first communion and different times like that. My issue is I don't want to support what that mass means. I would be willing to support the ritual of the self and remembering and being with the divine, but I don't want to support women as second class citizens. And I don't want to support the idea of this is the only church and all other churches are not actually the one church. I don't want to support those ideas. Yes. So I would say, I could not feel that.
But there are a lot of splinter groups. Is what I call them. Like I go to mass in a home or something, and they're all. The priest that usually says mass is not in. I didn't even know this word. He said he doesn't have his faculty. That would be like me not having my nursing license. The archdiocese won't let him. He had a job teaching school. It's good people and fired him because he's been elected in Jamaica. And, you know, they cut it off. But there are these groups that are out there that reordained a woman here in Indianapolis only years ago when she does now. So, you know, there are groups, to answer your question, where you, obviously, if you're in that group, you're not supporting all the things that I don't know what the word is.
You know, if it could go back to, I think what it was originally done, people participated. So, you know, if you could actively participate in someone, for me, all it was just aping. And I just can't go back and just ape prayers and be a robotic someone in a number. And I don't know, it's just done so robotically. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't feed your soul. If it could go back to probably what it was originally, when they were sitting at a table and having communion and praying in the sense of communing with each other and sharing thoughts, you know, that maybe could feed the soul, but it's certainly gotten into another thing.
I agree, Jenny. Well, let's just get sort of a little bit to the next section, and then I'll take a break. Let's see, where are we? So, bottom of 352, first column. We're going to be talking about the church and communion. So, see, community and communion, that's kind of why I wanted to follow up on that theme as it first appeared. Now, things get kind of loaded. The world of the gods is made manifest in spirituality and in sexuality. The celestial ones appear in spirituality, the earthly in sexuality.
I'm having a problem with that, because I don't see why there needs to be a split
between those two? Spirituality and sexuality, is that because we split them?
I don't know. But I'll give you an example.
Good.
I just happened to brought it along. I thought we'd take it, put a little parenthesis here. Maybe I'll introduce them. We'll take a break and we'll come back. I talked about this with you guys a couple years ago, I think, at your place when we did that transference thing. Mm-hmm. And it's a woman I worked with many years ago where there was a very strong erotic attraction. And I thought I'd just bring on a couple of dreams to show you how it works. About a year into the work, she dreamt that she and I were sitting in a room and there was no oxygen. I could breathe and she couldn't. So the oxygen there as air would be spirit, would be the spiritual side of the sexuality. Now I'm just touching the main points. We spent a whole day on this. In the dream about 2 months later, she dreamt she and I were sitting in a room wearing white smocks. See, that's the beginning of the recognition that there was a spiritual aspect to the sexuality, to the sexual feelings. Then, I'll read you a dream that came about 2 months after that. I'm in my room. In my room, the phone is ringing. I answer, and when I recognize the voice, Gary, I'm able to see his face. He is speaking very softly. The sense of it seeming that he is giving me something, yet also asking for something. His features are changing, his face gradually appearing owl-like. Now we are together in this room, his face returned to normal, kneeling before an owl. I'm not sure if Gary is telling me to open my eyes so I can see it, or to watch until the owl opens its eyes. So, you see, first she sees me as an owl, and then she discovers the owl in herself. That, by spirit, we don't mean Jesus. We mean the forward-creating aspect of the psyche will create a projection that is made vivid by a sexual attraction. And the way we see the other person that we are erotically fascinated with is a purposive presentation of the next part of our own psychological development. That makes sense? She sees me one way, she's fascinated with me because I have a certain characteristic, but soon that characteristic becomes a part of her own personality. And the whole thing is carried by eroticism.
And then the whole thing, she doesn't know whether she needs to open her eyes or wait for the owl. That's so beautiful, that symmetry there.
Mm-hmm.
Like the seen and being seen.
Mm-hmm.
By that inner thing. That's wonderful.
So I have to define our terms, and we'll take a break, and I'll give you two more dreams that show the same thing. How eros brings us to ourselves by virtue of attracting us to what we think somebody is, but it really is part of ourselves.
Before we leave this, she saw you, first you're over the phone, then she sees mm-hmm. you as an owl. Then does she see herself as an owl, or she just simply sees a projection?
She sees an owl.
That you're worshiping.
Yeah.
And you're both kneeling to worship the owl.
Right. But see, then that owl would be a part of her psyche.
Mm-hmm. Or it could represent the self.
Or
right?
Could be the self, yeah. Certainly could be the self. But what I wanted to get across is how eros works sometimes is that it's a desire and it carries a message. The desire is what he's going to be talking about as earthly. the message is what he's going to be talking about as spirituality. Spirit, remember, for Jung, is this part that of us that orders images, orders experiences. Let's take a break, and I'll give you a couple more dreams so we really get clear what he's driving at, and then we'll go back to the text. And anyway, I think we have to interpret the text. I don't agree with it all the time. So get up and move, stop thinking.